Hello and welcome to episode 6 of series 3 of the Poolside Pass podcast. On today's episode, I'm going to be speaking with Terry McKeever, head coach of Cal Bears Women's Swimming and Diving. And Terry's a coach with, you know, just a great track record of working with Olympic athletes, but also on the collegiate level, developing that women's program at Cal Bears to consistent top 10 national championship finishes, but also, you know, multiple national championship wins in her time there. So was really looking forward to sitting down with Terry and speaking about her career in sport, and I'm delighted to be able to share this episode with you. So before we get into the episode of Terry, it's just a quick line from our sponsors, Streamlined. Become a qualified swimming teacher with Streamlined in as little as 6 days. Learn at your own pace and be guided by our expert tutors. You can do your training face-to-face, online in real-time, or a combination of the two. Assessment can be in your club using videos or attending one of our assessment venues. We offer tailored, high-quality support. Quote the Poolside Pass for an extra 10% discount. So I think it's about time I introduce Terry McKeever. Welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
Thank you. Really well. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
So why don't we just start by getting a little bit of background from yourself about how you got into swimming and then ultimately ended up in coaching?
Yeah. Well, I was a competitive swimmer myself. I'm the oldest of 10. I'm actually the only one in my family that only did one sport. I did some other sports before, but I really got serious about swimming, just a little bit of tennis and a little bit of horseback riding and gymnastics, but I'm a little too tall for that. So as I got about 10 years old, got into swimming, made nationals here in the United States at 12, was able, probably the first age group of people, women, that were able to go to college and continue competing. So really feel blessed for that. And definitely had an impact on me doing what I do now. Originally, I was thinking I would be an elementary school teacher, or I have a high school math and science credential as well, and thought that my coaching would just primarily be limited to high school and maybe some club. But when I was doing my student teaching, while working on my credential, I did some volleyball coaching and some basketball, and just really kind of fell in love with coaching, got bit by the coaching bug. And then I had a chance to go back. I went to the University of Southern California, and 2 years out of graduating, the assistant moved on. So my head coach, Don Lamont at the time, asked me to come back and be the assistant, and worked on my master's in athletic administration, because I really felt like if I was going to coach, I'd love to coach for about 10 years. I kind of thought at the collegiate level, and then, you know, maybe go back and teach school, get married, have a family or whatever. It didn't work out exactly like that. It actually worked out better. After getting my master's and spending 3 years at USC as the assistant, I had the opportunity to go to Fresno State. It's a Division I school here in Central California. For the first 2 years, I coached the women. And then the last three, I was there a total of 5. So the last three, I was both the men's and women's coach. And then I got the job here at Berkeley in the fall or the summer of 92. And I'm in the middle of my 29th season here. So been pretty fortunate to be able to stay in the same place and geographically and educationally, and really feel blessed that I do get to teach. And in fact, you know, better than in a classroom where you might have 25 people kind of come through every hour, I get 25 to 30 women that I get to work with, you know, in the case of Natalie Coughlin, we spent 12 years together. So it's, I love being somebody's last coach. I really feel that athletics is such a powerful learning opportunity for life, and I really enjoy taking the sport and working on the whole person and really helping them see that the things they're learning through their sports are really going to be skills and tools that they're going to need for the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So it's been an awesome experience.
Excellent. So, as you just alluded to there, like the vast majority of your career you spent at Berkeley, California Golden Bears, with some terrific results over that time. Just talk us through kind of the first 5 years of that time at Cal, and kind of like getting it off the ground, getting it growing up, and then how you developed it into a program now that, you know, top 10 finish at NC2As all the time, like winning championships. That kind of journey of developing that program.
Yeah, I would say the first 5 years were incredibly tough, and probably more than a few times when I was like, oh man, I don't know if I'm going to make this. and I think you know, I think there's a couple things. Berkeley is a unique place. It's you know, it's got a nickname of being Berserkly, and definitely a beautiful place, awesome to be at a world-class university like this. But it really took me a little while to like find my footing. I think it was the first time I had coached where I was really struggling with the relationships, you know, like the previous coach didn't really want to move on. She had some family issues, so she moved on, and I kind of came in, and the group that was there, you know, really didn't sign up for me, and I didn't sign up for them. So it was a little bit of sort of growing pains, and the team was because of some of the challenges in the previous coach's home life, the team really was not really where it had been in the past. So it was kind of, you know, heading in the direction that the girls on the team at the time didn't want it to. And here was this young coach that they didn't really know anything about, and how was I gonna help, you know, help change it. So I think that kind of really worked against me a little bit and my confidence. And really when I got to the point, I think, you know, in that 5 year period and sort of in struggling, I think particularly in recruiting and some things, you know, I'd be work recruiting or talking to someone, and maybe that internal bell went off, like this might not be a good match, or this might not be someone I really would enjoy working with. But I would sort of justify it like, oh, well, they're fast, so I need to like make, you know, I need to keep recruiting them. I need to make it work. And I had an assistant at the time that we worked well together at the beginning, but it really turned into a not a very productive relationship, and definitely some struggles there. And you know, luckily there was not the internet or social media, because you know, I still had this little person on my shoulder, or heard the whispers of like, you only got the job because you're a woman, you know, you're going to get fired, blah, blah, blah. And I remember, I don't remember when, but I know like in my mind, it was like, okay, well, if I get fired, I'm just going to do things the way I want to do them. And I'm not going to be anybody but the best Terry. And if I succeed, great. If I don't, at least I can look myself in the mirror. You know, I think what I was really trying in sort of evaluating it, you know, I'd go to a swim clinic or whatever, and it would be, you know, Richard Quick or Mark Schubert or John Urbanchek. And so I saw all put, you know, most of them male, but I saw these world-class coaches talking about, you know, things. And I kept thinking like, well, I don't think that way, or that's not like, and it was, I was trying to be something I wasn't, until finally I just was like, you know what, I'm just going to be Terry, and it will appeal to some people. It won't appeal to others, and that's okay. And really kind of remember in my mind thinking, okay, I'm going to get the program in the top 10, and then like, I'm out, you know. And we got back in the top 10, I think in 1997 or 98, and, you know, haven't been out since. And as you mentioned, you know, the consistency, I think that's when I look back at my career, that's the thing I'm most proud of, is being able to have a program that, well, until last year was in the top three, for 11 years in a row. And because I think then it's not about, you know, a recruiting class or a particular athlete, it's about a group of women being able to come in and buy into something bigger than themselves, a program, a philosophy, where people have been able to come in and be the best versions of themselves. So fortunately, that's resulted in, you know, some trophies and success and some really amazing women that are doing amazing things in the world, you know, after their swimming. And that's just as rewarding as the swimming accolades. So I'm happy about that.
You mentioned there how when you was kind of first getting into it and you go to clinics and it'd be like mainly men in a room, all that kind of stuff, and the fact that in your role you're head coach for women swimming and diving, so you spent your career working with kind of women. I don't know if it's the same in America, but certainly in the UK a big topic for us is kind of coaching females. It tends to be something that maybe, I don't know, we don't tend to strike the right chord with. I think it's probably because coaching can be quite a male dominated profession sometimes. As a woman who coaches women, what have been your experiences on coaching females, and how have you managed to be so successful at it because you have?
Yeah. I think that's a good question. I think sometimes, you know, I think there are differences between men and women. And I think sometimes my experience has been that sometimes a male coach tends to like motivate with male strategies. You know, in general, men are motivated by results and rah-rah and that type of thing. And women tend to be motivated by relationships. Now, that doesn't mean they don't want to win or relationships aren't important to men, but I think it's, you know, finding that balance for each individual. You know, I'd like to think if I coach a combined program, I would be just as successful. I don't know. And that's okay. I think some of the advantages of being a female coaching females is that I've kind of lived that experience. I think some of the subtleties that I know when I've had men working with me, I'll say something like, oh, this is going on or that. And he's like, how do you even know that? And I go, I don't know. I guess it's because I'm a woman and I see it going on. Like I tell the girls sometimes, like, you can't pull that, you know, BS with me because I'm a woman and I've either had it done to me or I've seen it before. And like, we're not going to do that. I think in some ways I can have a more direct conversation with women, going women on women. I'm assuming men on men, you know, I would make an adjustment probably talking to a male. So there's definitely that. You know, I've asked you know, former athletes, like, are you worried about, you know, swimming for a female, and, you know, what are the challenges or whatever? And the biggest challenge seems to be that they, in their family structure, the female, the mom might have been more of the, you know, nurturing, where you go and the dad was a disciplinarian. So they sort of come into this environment, and I think some of them struggle with, like, okay, it's the female that's sort of putting the hammer down and you know, reinforcing and setting the boundaries, and then where do I go for this, like, nurturing? And I think that is an area where I grew and allowed myself to be vulnerable to, like, show them my nurturing side and the no nonsense side, you know, that I'm going to be different on the pool deck than if we're sitting in my office and we're going to have a question. You know, the pool deck is not to get into this long, like, we're working out there. If we need other things that we need to you know, pay attention to or whatever, we're going to do those at a different place. And I think coaching is very much about respect and trust and building that relationship. And so, you know, I try to talk about what I expect in a recruiting process, and particularly because I'm primarily coaching, you know, 18-year-olds and up, this is really about them taking ownership in their career right now. This is definitely a program where I tell people, like, their job's to come in here and coach me to be the best coach for you. Now, there are some non-negotiables, obviously, that are you know, in the program or the way I like to have things done. But I also believe that the best coach for any individual is that individual, and they have to be able to articulate that to me or our assistant or a national team coach or whatever, if they're going to be their best. They've got to have an awareness of what things work and why they work and what they need to be doing so that they can reach their full potential.
Absolutely. You've been a part of, you know, numerous, you know, great swimmers been part of your program, and you've been part of their journey. In the case of, you know, Donna Vollmer, one of America's most accomplished swimmers in recent years, of which the list is long, so to appear on that list is a great achievement. What impact do you think missing out on the 2008 Olympic selection had for her? Because, you know, a lot of swimmers, you know, myself, if that had been me, having qualified for some Athens and then just missed out on Beijing, maybe you could have thought, oh, that's maybe it for me. But then she came back and she swam at 2012 in London and also Rio in 2016. So for her, you know, what did you have a role to play in making sure she got over that disappointment in 2008? And how did you help her with that?
Yeah. I think if Dana had made the team in 08, she never would have still been swimming by 12 or 16 or broke the world record. You know, after her missing the team in 08, we actually, Milton Elms has worked with me for years, and we conspired to send, he and Shane Gould were working on a drowning prevention program in Fiji. So we sent Dana to Fiji for about 3 weeks to, like, help them and just not have to watch the Olympics. Fortunately, she had one more year at university here. And I think that played a big factor in it. She knew that she was gonna swim collegiately. It so happens it was the first year we won our first national title. And Dana very much is motivated by being part of a group and helping other people, and I think it gave her the opportunity to really check in with, hey, why am I swimming and what's important to me and what is success for me, not what is success for other people. And, you know, then she has this great London Olympics, and I remember when she called me after the birth of her first son and said, hey, I think I want to swim again. And I was like, really? You know, and then that became not so much like, am I going to make the Olympic team? It was never about, I want to make another Olympic team. It was more about, hey, I want to get healthy. And I want to, she'd had a lot of injuries during her career. And I think some of the time off just allowed her body to heal. And then as she came back, really the whole emphasis was on, you know, quality of movement and health. And all her strength training was done with a physical therapist all around, like good mechanics and everything. So, yeah, I mean, definitely someone that, and she loves exploring the feel and the sensation of the water and problem solving and questioning things and trying, wasn't afraid, particularly at the end of her career, wasn't afraid to try something different, even though she had had so much success. And I really think that allowed for the longevity and the level of success that she did have, you know.
In many ways, there, she sounds like almost, you're describing it as like the perfect swimmer to coach, in terms of she loves being in the water, problem solving, but also she sounds like, very much like you explained earlier, in that she wants to be the person, like the best coach for you is you, and she was very good at figuring that out.
Yeah.
So undoubtedly, through your career, you've come across athletes who maybe having, you know, difficulty progressing with their career or stepping forward with kind of time progressions. How do you work with these swimmers on helping them come through those difficult times that, you know, every swimmer has at some point?
Yeah, I think there's a couple strategies I've used through the years, particularly with the collegiate program. I like if someone's a 200 freestyler and we're working on their freestyle, I think having them race a 200 IM or a 200 backstroke or a 200 fly or even a 200 breaststroke, they can have that racing experience and maybe notice something in their, you know, off event that they just aren't even paying attention to anymore in their more ego events. So I think that can help and doesn't hurt to sort of mix up the variety. I'm a firm believer in training like all strokes, regardless of what you do. I think also working on technique. A lot of times if I'm a butterflyer, like Dana, as a butterflyer, we would work on our breaststroke sometimes. And there might be things in her breaststroke that, you know, I could kind of hint at where she wasn't as emotionally attached to how it felt for her butterfly. So I think that's a great strategy. And then similar to what I said before, sort of defining success, you know, sometimes I think for us, we only look at like the end result. And I think sometimes you can have a slower overall time, but you can be doing things that down the road could potentially lead to, you know, a faster time. So it's trusting the journey. It's trusting the process. It's that growth mindset of knowing that, you know, I don't like any, I think any journey worthwhile doesn't always, you know, go on the exact path that we want. It's got an ebb and a flow and a peaks and valleys, and how we respond, particularly in those valleys, and is really, really indicative of how high the peaks can get, you know? And I think sometimes too, when you struggle like that, then when you do have a breakthrough, it's even more meaningful. I always tell the girls, like, you know, sometimes freshman year, they'll have a good breakthrough, or particularly like an athlete that, you know, maybe hasn't, not like a Dana or that hasn't had that success, but they come in and improve. And I think what's really hard for a lot of them to realize is the hard work that you put in for that improvement. Now you're in that stratosphere where you're going to have to work three times, four times as hard for incremental improvement. And that, I honestly, I think it does deter a lot of people. It takes a special individual to keep after it and keep consistent and keep grinding and maybe not seeing the overall reward that they want. You know, it's believing in them, like I said, in themselves, and believing in a process. So it's, I think that's one of the hardest things we do, you know.
You spoke there about kind of the growth mindset aspect of it. Is that something you try and look out for when you're recruiting, or is it something that a lot of the athletes generally have already?
You know, I definitely try to ask questions. I mean, recruiting is the most unofficial or unscientific thing you can do, you know, because you never, like, it's just the tip of an iceberg, right? You know, and you can see somebody race, but until you spend day in and day out, you don't know, like, sort of what their challenges are, or what skills they might have that can help them improve. But it's definitely something that we talk a lot about here in the program. One thing that I think has been huge, particularly in the last 4 to 5 years, is just this whole idea of failure. I think young people are really, really have a high fear of failure. And I just really believe that failure is an important part of succeeding. You know, like if we're not failing, we're not trying something new, and we can't be doing the same thing and hope for different results, right? So I think flipping that mindset that failure is really, really valuable and really important. I had a young lady that swam for me, and I remember the, you know, sort of summing up her career, she said, "What I learned here at Cal was how to fail quickly and move on." And to me, that's like one of the best compliments I could get. You know, it's not, I don't want to fail or I'm scared of it. It's like, no, I learned how to do it. And then that now what do I do next, you know, and not stay in that. And either people are afraid of it or they get to that point and then they get stuck in this, you know, what I refer to as a rabbit hole. They just keep going down the rabbit hole, you know? So I think that's a really, really important, you know, tool to bring in, tool for, I like to talk to them about my jobs to like help you get to the blocks with this metaphoric toolbox that has physical tools, it has mental tools, it has emotional tools. And all those tools are built through variety of training and talking and you know, programs, whatever it is, but they've got to get to the block and know that they can access any of those tools regard, you know, whatever the race demands, they'll be able to draw upon those tools almost automatically rather than, you know, going, I don't know what to do here. You know?
Yeah. So I want to speak now a little bit about kind of, we spoke about more kind of the working with people aspect of your job. I want to speak a little bit now about kind of the more technical and physiological aspect of the job. Some of your most successful swimmers, you know, have competed in 100 meters or below. So kind of those more sprinter type athletes, you know, Jessica Hardy, Dana Volmer, Natalie Coughlin, etc. How do you set up a program that hits the mark for those kind of athletes every time? Because I think, I know certainly from my perspective, when you're working with athletes who maybe do 200 and above, it's perhaps not an exact science when you do stuff, but when you get down to those kind of shorter events, it seems that one thing can throw the whole plan off. So how do you try and set it up so it hits the nail on the head?
Yeah. Well, it's probably good recruiting, right, to start with. But I think it does go back to that communication. You know, when I look at even the list of women that you just shared, like they all sprint, but they come at it from different perspectives. You know, so I think it's looking at that athlete and like, okay, what's the best part about what they do, and then devising a program that exploits those strengths. You know, instead of, I've used Natalie as an example before. I mean, particularly in Natalie's time, there wasn't anybody probably in the world that was a better underwater swimmer. You know, that was a very underutilized skill. And, you know, she fell into it probably from some injuries in her age group swimming. But I can remember people saying like, well, how do you get Natalie to stay underwater? And it was like, I didn't have to trick Natalie to stay underwater. She recognized that it was important, and she would do it, like warm up everything else. She would commit to that, and she would do it without doing. So I think then too, like I look at, you know, so then I say you have another backstroker, you have a Rachel Bootsma or somebody else, and trying to have them swim the way Natalie, I think a lot of coaches go, okay, well, this is the way Natalie swims, so now all my backstrokers need to swim that way. And I think it's really looking at those individual things, really like to pay attention a lot with like their relationship with the water. We spend a lot of time talking about using the water and, you know, how do you do that? I think that's different for every person. You know, I have a little thing I always tell them, like you're fighting the water. And if you get in a fight with the water, guess who wins? You know, the water is going to kick your, you know what? So, you know, it's talking about that and having, again, going back to some of what I said before, but paying attention to things that maybe they stopped paying attention to, and whether it be showing them, whether they look at it with somebody else. We do a lot of cross training, you know, and or teaching, I guess, is a better way of saying it. So Even like maybe not a breaststroker and a breaststroker doing a turn, but maybe someone who's not even a breaststroker watching an underwater pullout, and then, you know, not saying like, hey, when you're bringing your arms up, like I see all this resistance coming, you know, like, so it's not giving you a specific thing. It's just giving that athlete, like, I see this is working against you. How do you clean it up and work on it yourself? And so we do a lot of that. And I think it's working on athleticism, particularly for sprinters, I think is really important. You know, I think sometimes swimmers, we say, oh, you know, they got into swimming because they weren't a good athlete. But the reality is anyone that's a world-class swimmer or a very good swimmer is a very good athlete, you know? So I think it, to me, athleticism is a awareness of what your body's doing, efficiency. And so working on that in the weight room, you know, dry land wise and everything else. Just, and then I think for sprinters in particular, there's that, that athletic confidence, right? That you can see, like when they walk into the pool or whatever, like, okay, that, like, do they have athletic, physical confidence that they are ready to perform? And I think that's a really important piece that maybe people don't think about as much. And so that's something else that we talk about and try to work on.
So we, right at the very start, you mentioned about, you know, how consistent you guys are at NC2As and how proud you are of that consistency. You've also got a great record of putting swimmers on international teams in the summer when they're predominantly going race long course. How do you manage to turn around from racing short course and racing really well, short course yards in like middle of March to then going swimming, you know, world-class performances, long course meters in the summer? For you, how do you convert short course yards into long course meters? Because I imagine, well, for us, when we go from short course meters to long course meters, it's, some swimmers find it difficult originally, it's quite a big change. So if you're going from short course yards, which is even shorter, right, it can be quite a challenge. So how do you manage to do that?
Well, we're really fortunate here in that on campus now we have two long course pools. But actually my entire time at Cal, we go long course in the morning, no matter what time of year it is. And short course in the afternoon, definitely during the collegiate season. When we get into the summer and spring, we might go a couple more long course sessions in the afternoon. But I think it's really important to do both, like all the time. You know, I think the walls, like one thing where I think the world has caught the United States is around the walls. You know, when I first started doing international competitions, I remember just like, oh man, nobody knows how to turn except, you know, the Americans, or they just sort of took it for granted instead of really like, an integral part of the race. And I want to say it was like 2015 or so. I remember like sitting there in Kazan and going, okay, like we don't have an advantage anymore on the turns. Like the world has sort of caught up to like what valuing them, I guess. So I think it's talking about both. I think it's setting a expectation in your program that both will be important, and I don't think you have to compromise one for the other. Some people maybe better on, you know, short course than long course? Yes, like absolutely. But I think if the program is set up where you value both and you train both, you know, so we go long course in the morning, short course in the afternoon, it doesn't mean like all our quality work is short course, even during the collegiate season. There, we also do quality work in the morning so that you know what you should be doing long course and you know what you should be doing short course year round, you know, and so that, I think that's been a big factor. I think the biggest factor is probably just people expecting that, okay, like both is going to be important. You know, we have a lot of rules in the collegiate environment with how many hours a week and how many days of training and everything. And when we get out into spring and summer in particular, you know, we don't have those limitations, and we definitely have people on our team that have national and international aspirations. And we have some women that don't, that isn't really, you know, that important to them. It's more around the collegiate, and sort of my philosophy has always been in the spring and the summer that we're going to train, I'm going to train the team for the highest denominator of what the goal is for an individual. So if that's meddling at an Olympics or meddling on a world championship team, then I'm going to run the program that I think that will be able to do. And if you are coming every day and you're willing to contribute to that goal, whether that's your goal or not, but you're willing to contribute to the environment where that can be possible, you're more than welcome. If you're not, then you need to go do something else. And then you can come back for the college season, you know, and that sounds kind of harsh. I don't mean it to sound harsh, but it's like, we're not, you know, the great thing about college is like, we're all going to go swim, you know, Stanford this day, and then we're going to go to our Pac-12 championships, and then we're going to go to NCAAs. Like, so when you get in the summer and you have these different goals and different aspirations, I think it's really important. It has been important for me to set the tone of like, this is the highest goal of anyone in the program. So we all need to rise to that goal, and I need to run a program to that goal. And if you can't, that's totally okay, but don't get in our way, you know? And it's like that on the college season as well. If our goal and aspiration is to buy for an NCAA title, whether you're going to make NCAAs or you're just struggling to make the travel team, you need to create, you know, be willing to commit to that type of environment, or there isn't a place here for you. And, you know, that I at times have felt uncomfortable saying that. And I don't feel uncomfortable saying that anymore, because I'm not going to apologize for having a high standard of expectation and excellence. And if that isn't what you want, there are hundreds of other universities, you know, but that's what has been communicated, that that's what the expectation is here. So if you get here and you can't or don't want to do that anymore, then that's okay. But you don't get to stay here and be part of the program, you know?
Yeah. So it's kind of just creating that culture of, well, we're here to do a job. And if you don't want to be on that, then, you know, you can go and play ultimate frisbee or whatever it is.
Yeah. You know, you said earlier, like, what was it? I think particularly my first 5 years here, I was probably coaching toward the middle. You know, I, as a young coach, I didn't want to have an uncomfortable conversation. I didn't like it when people would go home and like think, you know, bad things of me or whatever it is. Or if I saw something, I'd maybe kind of wait before, like, should I say something? Should I not? You know, I had to have the perfect speech before I would say anything. And I think where I've really grown is like, you know what, I'm going to say stupid things sometimes. But if I say, I have these, like, what I call teaching moments. Like, if I see something that needs to be corrected, if it's at an NCAA championship or it's at practice this afternoon, we're going to stop. And we're going to talk about why that isn't okay, you know, and then we're going to go back and do it again. If somebody, you know, earlier this week, we had some discipline stuff and I suspended some people, and then Saturday practicing, and like, I just got the girl out, young lady out, and I said, look, quit feeling sorry for yourself or get out of here. Like you served your suspension. The woe is me. It's not serving you or the team. Either get on board or like, I'll see you Monday, you know? And like, she kind of snapped out of it. And yes, it wasn't warm, fuzzy, but that, you know, in the moment. And then as she walked out, I said, you understand what I was saying? And she said, yeah, I would never have done that as a young coach, because I would have wanted to try to keep everybody happy. And I don't think you're coaching like, I'm not saying your goal is to make people uncomfortable, but by nature of calling yourself a coach, your job is to find out what their goal is individually and collectively and hold them to that standard or beyond. And yes, people falter a little bit, but that faltering like needs to be brought to their attention so that they can make an adjustment. It isn't fair to like see something for a week and then go to the meet and say, well, yeah, you haven't been doing that right for a week. You know, it's like, well, you need to tell them now. And yes, in a way with respect and where they can hear you. But it's not always about saying the most popular thing, right? You know, so I think that's, I definitely coach to the highest denominator. And like I said, the other people need to like rise to that level, or I don't know, life might get so uncomfortable. You might not want to be there anymore, you know, but I also feel like, you know, the only thing I can offer anybody in life is my time, energy, and effort. And I want to do that with people that are appreciative of that and responding of that, and that also inspire me. You know, I want to, it's not just my job to go inspire and coach and be ready to go. You know, it's their job to show up ready to go. Like, if I think someone's kind of showing up and not bringing their best on a regular basis, I go, how would you like it if I just came to practice every day and I didn't write a practice? I just made it up, you know, so it gets them thinking about that, again, that this is a partnership, not just, you know, I'm doing the work and then you get to pick and choose what you want to do. And I think that goes with even, you know, writing a set or whatever, like I'll say, well, how was that? You know, and they'll say, oh, that was good. I'm like, okay, well, what was good about it? Or I didn't like that. Well, what didn't you like about it? You know, to get so that it gives, like, I can write something and I can expect it to be executed a certain way, but I can't make them do that, right? They have to be willing to do that on their own. We often do spin in our spin cycling in our program, not this year for a variety of reasons, but and you know, one of my metaphors I always tell them is like when the spin instructor says go down and turn, you know, turn the resistance up, do you just go down there and put your hand and fake it, or do you really turn the resistance, right? Nobody knows, but that time when you're being asked to turn the resistance, that happens every day, multiple times at practice. It happens multiple times in a race. And how you respond to that is hugely important if you want to be the best that you're capable of being, you know? And I think it's just kind of bringing those moments to their attention, you know?
Absolutely. So I just want to finish the main part of the interview, talking about your roles on USA teams. You've been an assistant coach. You're the first female to be a head coach of a USA Olympic team. How different were these roles? You know, how much adjusting did you need to do to having that kind of role to what your day-to-day role is?
You know, I think probably one of the most powerful learning experiences for me was being able to serve on national teams, was watching different head coaches, right? Everybody's a head coach, but what head coach can be an assistant coach? Not every head coach can be an assistant coach. Like, who can support the head coach? Who can support a direction, an idea, a way of doing things that isn't exactly the way that you would do it, you know? So I feel like that's what my job is as an assistant, is to respect what the head coach is, the direction that they're running things, and like, what do they want, you know, ask questions. What do you need or want from me? When you're the head coach, I think it's more about setting that tone and communicating with your assistants what you would like them to do, where you need to be supported, knowing what your strengths and your weaknesses are so that you can be supported in both of those. And you know, definitely the national team is more about, I'm a firm believer, this is one of my pet peeves, is I think sometimes when we go on national teams, like, you got all this coaching expertise, and I think sometimes we just start telling the athletes things. And my philosophy has always been to like ask the athlete, are you open to some feedback? Because I don't know that person really well. And if I or three other coaches start saying something unsolicited or maybe differences, that I don't think really empowers your athletes. So I think it's really important I feel like it's really important, and something that I've always tried to do is say, you know, do you want the feedback? What, ask for permission to give feedback rather just assume that, well, I'm this great coach. I have something that I can help you with, you know? So that's been something that I try to do. And then I think, just being able, like, what a powerful learning experience, not only from the other coaches, but from the other athletes, and just being able to watch the differences of people that are world-class has been really, really valuable in my career, and then ask them why they do certain things or whatever. Early on, I had the chance to work with Jenny Thompson a couple times, and I just learned so much watching her at that stage of her career go through, you know, being in medical school and go through a championship qualifying meet and then a training camp and then a world championships or Olympics with relays and heats and semis and finals. It really opened my eyes to what someone of that level, all the things they take into consideration. So I'm really grateful for that experience.
Cool. Good stuff. So just as we finish up, we always ask our guests to kind of sum up something in three key points. I'm going to ask you today, Terry, for your top three points for coaching great female swimmers.
Top three points. Be as good a listener as talker, maybe a better listener than a talker. I think respect the differences and of each individual and that they all aren't motivated or should even train the same if they even swim the same event. And what's the other thing? I think just keep it fun too, you know, like have fun, like as a coach, have fun. As an athlete, have fun. And I would just say my number one advice for anyone is whether you're the athlete or the coach, like stay true to who you are. You know, like I said earlier, like that's when I figured out that my job was just to be the best Terry, not the best some other coach, that's when good stuff happened. And that's just to me a really powerful, powerful lesson I had to maybe learn the hard way. So I like to impart that.
Awesome. Terry, thank you very much for your time. I know I certainly picked up on a lot just from our 45 minutes or so of discussion. So thank you very much for that. I'm sure the listeners will pick up lots from that as well. Listeners, thank you very much for tuning in this time. Again, I hope you really enjoyed the episode. I want to take this opportunity to point you towards our Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We're at The Poolside Pass. And of course, our website, www.thepoolsidepass.com. Until next time, take care.